Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today we will continue reading the April-May 2024 issue of Guideposts magazine with articles like Deliverance Alley. Overcoming Addiction, Deliverance Alley. A clear, quiet voice in the still of the evening led this drug user from the streets to a life of service. By Rhonda Wilmingham, Dallas, Texas. The place I call Deliverance Alley is a vacant lot of grass and dirt in a neglected South Dallas neighborhood. Drive by and you won't see much. A sign on a deli across the street reads, "No trespassing, prostitution, drug dealing, loitering, weapons, or criminal activity will be tolerated." Why do I call this seemingly godforsaken slice of scarred urban ground Deliverance Alley? What if I said it's where God delivered me one afternoon almost 2 decades ago? When I landed in Deliverance Alley, I wasn't just homeless. I was far from home in every possible way. I'd been born into a military family in Kansas City, Missouri. My dad, Wendell Jean Parker, was a lieutenant colonel in the Army. My mother, Mary Ann Parker, raised me and my 3 younger brothers. My dad served in Korea and Vietnam. I was 5 when he was transferred to a base in Europe. It was the 1960s. Dad was upfront with me and my siblings about the advantages of moving to Europe. "We are a black family," he said. "There is a lot less racism over there than in America." Sad but true. The military was one of the nation's first major institutions to desegregate. On our base in Europe, I played with kids regardless of skin color. We traveled to European cities on vacation, visited art museums, and learned German. Teachers at school taught us about the realities of slavery and the many contributions made by black people to American life. Everything changed when we returned stateside in the early 1970s. Just off the plane in South Carolina, I noticed white and colored signs on the restrooms. That was illegal, but the airport didn't seem to care. My father always spoke his mind, and I am every inch his daughter. "Excuse me," I said to a passerby, pointing at the whites' only bathroom. "What color do I have to be to go in there?" The woman regarded me with an expression of utter disdain. "How dare you," she seemed to say before stalking off. Dad yanked me right out of that airport. "You have no idea what you're doing," he hissed. "You could get us all killed." We settled in Texas, where my dad was promoted to assistant commanding officer at Fort Hood and bought a house in Dallas for Mom and us kids. My brothers were good kids and had jobs after school, but they were still harassed by police almost every day. Living in a constant state of fear wears you down. I told Dad I wanted to join the Army, but he said it was no place for a woman. I turned my back and moved to New York. I worked as a customer service manager for telecom companies. I made good money. There was one problem. Remember how I said I was my father's daughter? That had a downside. Dad parented my brothers and me with military discipline. We followed a schedule, did chores, and never talked back. Every weekend, he made us straighten up our rooms like little soldiers. We had to clean, fold, and put everything away. When I say clean, I mean even the baseboards. I chafed under Dad's rules and told him I wasn't in the Army. I even wrote him a letter when I was little telling him I'm glad he'd be sent to Vietnam because now I didn't have to clean my room. Imagine receiving such a letter from your child. On my own for the first time in New York, I gave free rein to my contrarian side. I partied on weekends and enjoyed the nightlife. I met and married a man who'd seen combat in the military, but his PTSD contributed to him abusing me physically. I had to leave that marriage for fear of my life. I returned to Dallas and met another man. I fell hard. They say love is blind. Tell me about it. I didn't even realize at first that he sold drugs. He was good-looking and seemed to do well financially, and he treated me like a queen. Turned out he was riding the 1980s cocaine wave by cooking and selling crack. I can't explain why, but at some point I decided to join him. Maybe it was that misguided love, more desperation than devotion. I started doing drugs myself and dealing. I had been raised in church and I believed in God. I knew I was violating every moral principle Mom and Dad had tried to instill in me. I was aware that I had crossed a line and might never be able to turn back. So many addicts can't. That is what addiction does to you. It takes over your life. Totally. Eventually, even the drugs couldn't dull my shame and self-loathing. To this day, I am haunted by the time a little girl, just a wisp of a thing, came to the door of a crack house I ran. "Is my mama here?" she asked. were hungry, and she took our food stamps. The woman had tried to sell the food stamps for drug money. "Go take care of your kids," I screamed at her, surprised by my rage. But I went right back to selling drugs. It was as if I had lost my soul. Eventually, I left that bad boyfriend behind, but not the drug trade. I discovered I was pregnant with my boyfriend's child. I vowed to go straight, but was soon back selling drugs to support myself. Arrested for drug possession, I was forced to ask my parents to take temporary custody of my son. They went ballistic at first, but I was their daughter, and they did what they could to support me and my child. I begged God so many times to help me get sober, but my contrarian spirit was too strong. Deep inside, I refused to give my life to God the way I had given my life to drugs and addiction. That's when I wound up at Deliverance Alley. I was homeless, just released from another stint behind bars, and ready to forget my trouble by getting righteously high. Night was falling, and I figured I was out of last chances. It was 2007. Deliverance Alley was a popular spot for addicts. There was an old sofa on the grass and a bucket for a bathroom. A bunch of my drug-dealing friends were there, and they welcomed me back. I sat on the couch, prepped my crack pipe, raised it to my lips. Out of nowhere, a voice spoke in my mind. "Say goodbye to all this, Rhonda." I jumped up, looked around. Was someone playing a trick on me? The voice spoke again, same words, even louder, clearer. I freaked out. I ran across the street. I looked back at the vacant lot, and I didn't recognize it, as if I'd been transported to another place. Some kind of powerful presence seemed to come down and root my feet to the sidewalk. I heard people speaking. "Queen, you all right?" That was my street name. Everything seemed far away. I took the drugs out of my pocket and handed them to someone. It was as if I had to let go of something more than just the drugs. I felt a warmth enfold me. I broke down weeping. The presence freed my feet and directed my steps to a place called Dallas International Street Church. They run a one-year residential discipleship program that includes counseling and addiction recovery. I laid down my contrarian spirit, admitted that I was powerless, and surrendered myself to that life-giving program. To this day, I can't explain how it all happened, only that I felt as if my soul had been freed. Fast forward 17 years. I am sober, married, and the founder of an organization called Making It Count, Incorporated, which offers housing and street support services to people like I once was. Lost, homeless, and wondering if there's any hope left for them. I helped them see there is. I reconciled with my child and my parents before my dad died in 2015. I made amends for the ways I had hurt him, including that mean letter I'd sent him in Vietnam. I came to accept that for a man like him, strict discipline was the way he best knew to show love. I forgave him for that. I am also grateful to him. I believe it was his military discipline he'd instilled in me that enabled me to form the daily responsibilities that helped me stick with recovery. God guided me, but I had to do the work. I run Making It Count, Incorporated the same way. Guests in my sober living house do chores, keep their rooms spotless, and stick to a schedule. As an active addict, the only structure in your life is getting the next fix. Recovering addicts need new structures. Being contrarian and questioning the status quo are necessary sometimes. Addiction recovery is not one of those times. My guests sometimes chafe at my discipline. In the long run, they are grateful, just as I am. In recovery, surrender equals freedom. Since Making It Count Incorporated was founded in 2010, we have distributed more than 100,000 meals, 75,000 hygiene kits, and 12,500 coats to people who need them. We partner with churches and other regional service providers. Every Wednesday, we launder people's clothes for free. We have been recognized by numerous Dallas civic organizations, and I recently received a community service award from the Greater Northern Dallas Business and Professional Women's Club. I give all my credit to God and my tireless volunteers. Making It Count, Inc. is now in the process of designing and getting permits for our new headquarters. I envision a full-service resource center for homeless people struggling with substance use, a place of love, acceptance, and pathways to recovery. I sometimes ask if it's possible to get sober without bringing God into your life. I suppose it might be, but that hasn't been my experience. It was God who spoke to me that day at Deliverance Alley and moved my feet and soul in the right direction. There's no other explanation. Guess where I plan to locate that headquarters? That's right, Deliverance Alley. My husband and I recently bought that vacant lot. We do street ministry there now. I can't wait until the building goes up and we can begin offering deliverance on a major scale. Like I said, there is always hope. There is always another chance. That's God's promise, and God always delivers on his promises. For more on this story, see Family Room. Animals and Healing, I Called Him Eddie Cream Cheese, by Crystal Braden, Aurora, Colorado. He was never the dog I would have chosen, but he chose me. My little chihuahua, Paco, was one of a kind. He and I had been through a lot together. I thought of him as my soul dog, a gift from God. He'd come with me to Colorado when I moved in with my son to help with his twin daughters, Piper and Mia. Paco was sweet, affectionate, and perfectly behaved, particularly with the girls, who were six at the time. Then, after 5 years in Colorado, my beloved Paco got sick. The vet did a series of tests. "It's best for Paco to let him go," he told me. I put Paco to sleep, yet my feelings did not die with him. I wandered around the apartment with his collar in my hand. There was his empty bed in the corner. There was his stuffed fox, his favorite toy. There was a spot on the couch where we used to snuggle. I told myself that Paco was no longer in pain, that he was playing on the other side of the Rainbow Bridge, chasing butterflies and squirrels until we could be reunited. It didn't help. "Lord, I'm so lost without Paco." "No more dogs," I said, scooting Paco's bed under my own, so I wouldn't have to see it. I couldn't bear that kind of loss again. A week after Paco died, my granddaughters talked me into going to a shelter to look for a new pet. A kitten, I reminded them. Our cat might like the company. And two cats would meet our building's two-pet limit, so I wouldn't have to entertain any thoughts of getting a new dog. "We don't have kittens available right now," the lady at the desk told us. The girls sighed. "I guess we have to go home," Mia said. "We can come back again, right?" Piper asked. "When they have more?" "Absolutely," I said. I steered them toward the exit, past a row of enclosures with glass doors. Click, click, click. We turned to the enclosure where the noise was coming from and saw a big black pug. He wasn't young. His muzzle was already turning gray. He was obese, but that didn't stop him from dancing on his hind legs, his toenails tapping the glass. As we headed for the exit, he followed us, waddling sideways. When he could no longer keep up with us, he let out a little squeal. "Pick me," he seemed to say. "Pick me." "Can we take him home?" the girls pleaded. "Please." The pug wagged his stubby tail, a goofy, hopeful grin on his face. "We decided on a kitten, I said. At least I had. "But he's perfect," Mia said. "Mia and I will walk him and feed him and give him everything he needs," Piper said. I still didn't want a dog, especially not this old, overweight pug. But I couldn't deny the girls. "I guess I don't mind having him in the apartment," I said. "But remember, he's your dog. I'm not going to take care of him. You are." "We will," the twins promised. The shelter didn't know anything about the pug's past. They estimated he was about 8 years old. He didn't even have a name. The twins named him Edgar, Eddie for short. The girls were thrilled when we got home with their new pet, but not as thrilled as Eddie was. He got the zoomies, dashing around the apartment as if to say, "I'm home, I'm home." Even I couldn't help smiling, but I had no intention of getting attached. Eddie had other ideas. Every time I turned around, he was at my side. He made his presence known in other less pleasant ways, too. He had accidents, leaving puddles and poo around the apartment. He drooled all over the place. One evening, I came into the kitchen and found he'd gotten into the trash and strewn it across the kitchen floor. "He's no Paco," I thought, bending down to clean up the mess. I deposited the last of the trash back into the can. "I thought you girls were going to be responsible for Eddie," I said as I reached for a paper towel to wipe up another of his puddles. "He's too stinky," said Mia, wrinkling her nose. "You should have known this would happen," I thought, spraying cleaner on the floor. The girls had the best of intentions to take care of Eddie, but they were only 11, not old enough for that kind of responsibility. "I don't want a dog," I told Eddie right to his face. He grinned as if to say, "Of course you do. I'm your dog." "No, my heart belonged only to Paco. I'll take care of this dog, Lord, but I won't love him." Eddie didn't mind that I didn't return his love. He seemed happy just to be with me. He even listened patiently when I told him about Paco. In fact, he was drawn to his predecessor's things. When he came upon Paco's stuffed fox, he grabbed it in his mouth like it was the most amazing thing ever and twirled around the room with it, squealing and drooling. Later, I found him snuggled up in Paco's bed that I'd hidden away. One evening, I was sitting in front of the TV, not really paying attention to the show that was on. I missed Paco so much. I held his collar in my hand for comfort. Eddie, as usual, was right beside me. "This was Paco's collar," I said. Eddie lowered his muzzle to sniff the collar. Then he bumped it with his head. He buried his flat face into it, as if trying to put it on himself. "I'm your dog," he seemed to be saying again. "You're my human. Don't you get it?" Eddie was so grateful for every little joy in his life. Was I being foolish by not following his example? "You deserve more than just being taken care of," I said, stroking his head and feeling so many feelings break loose inside me. Feelings I hadn't wanted to let go of for a dog I didn't want to let go of. "You deserve to be loved too." After that, I stopped trying to guard my heart. Soon it was hard for me to imagine watching TV or even sitting on the couch without Eddie snuggling close, his little front leg draped over mine as if to confirm that we belonged together. I grew to love his face, so unlike Paco's. With his flat muscle and downturned mouth, he looked like a gangster in an old movie. A sweet little gangster I nicknamed Eddie Cream Cheese. I had Eddie for 8 years before he got too sick. Once again, the vet told me I had to let my dog go. The vet came over to the apartment so Eddie could spend his final hours at home. As ever, he was grateful for every minute he had. I knew how he felt. My dogs and I weren't meant to be together on earth forever, but I would cherish the time God gave us. Never again would I push away love because I was afraid of loss. Eddie taught me love was fearless and asked nothing in return. I stroked his grizzled head one last time and whispered, "I love you, Eddie Cream Cheese. Thank you for choosing me." I'm Sandy Summers, and you are listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. From our Facebook fans, messages from above, Diane Murkow. My grandson pitches for his high school baseball team. When they made the playoffs, I was so excited to watch him play. The day of the big game, I arrived to find the baseball field empty. A passerby informed me the game had been moved at the last minute to St. Clair High School, miles away. If I hurried, I could make it. I started driving and realized I didn't know where I was going. So I pulled over and looked up St. Clair on my GPS. There were no direct routes, just a series of unfamiliar back roads. I was sure to get turned around. My heart sank. It was the first time I was going to miss an important game. Lord, now what? Just then a school bus whizzed past. The words on the back were easy to make out. St. Clair. I followed that bus all the way to the school and arrived in time for the second inning. Reverend William Taylor. My wife and I had driven down from Washington State to Portland, Oregon to visit her sister. We passed a church a few blocks from her sister's home. Something about the little brick building just spoke to me. If I were ever going to pastor a church, that would be it, I told my wife. We both laughed. I don't know what prompted me to say that. I worked as the assistant to a pastor, but had never considered becoming a pastor myself. I forgot about the comment until 4 years later, when I was looking for a new job. I got a phone call from a church offering me a pastoral position. I looked up the address. I couldn't believe it. It was the Little Brick Church in Portland. I worked there for the next 30 years before retiring. God had the perfect job in mind for me long before I found it. Beth Gormong. It was still dark out when I took our beetle Max for his morning walk. Things had been tough recently. My husband's income had gone down. I was trying to bring in some extra money with my writing. I'd submitted several stories, but I hadn't heard back from anyone. It was hard to stay optimistic. Up ahead, something caught my eye. Lord, do I see what I think I see? I said out loud. Is that even scientifically possible? Cutting across the black pre-dawn sky was a magnificent rainbow. Remarkably, it reminded me as the sun rose, lighting up the sky for the rest of our walk, a miraculous reminder to keep looking up, even when I feel down. Faith and Living, Thrive Again, Four Lessons from a Woman's Retreat Leader and Harried Mom by Claire McGarry, Windham, New Hampshire. Once when my children were 8, 6, and 2, I didn't just have a bad mothering day. I had a bad mothering week. I yelled at my kids, they misbehaved more, and my frustration level hit the roof. On Saturday, my husband told me, "I'll take care of the kids. You go take care of yourself." I grabbed my car keys and journal, then dashed for the door. I ended up at the outdoor chapel of a retreat center. I gazed at a cross with a backdrop of a lake behind and cried and prayed and journaled for 3 solid hours. I walked to my car with a new lightness in my step, and it struck me that I couldn't wait to return to the life I'd run away from. I couldn't wait to get home and be the best mother possible to my 3 children. That inspired me to hold retreats for mothers and caregivers centered around prayer and reconnecting with God. Here are some of the practices that women told me helped them the most. Then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. Mark chapter 6, verse 51, NIV. Pray a word or two. Since I frequently felt overwhelmed, I needed a word or phrase I could easily focus on each day. I asked God to give me an idea that was actionable, something I could do daily that would make me more faith-filled. When I heard with grace, I knew it was exactly what I needed. I started every task whispering with grace in my heart. I fed and dressed my children with grace. I washed dishes and did laundry with grace. I greeted the cashier at the grocery store with grace. This short prayer transformed the most mundane task into a blessing. Still, I couldn't imagine it helping on a day when everything went wrong. Oh, how I had underestimated God. Adding with grace invited God into the storms of my day and diffused each situation. When I corrected my kids with grace, they understood better how they needed to change their behavior. When I spoke to the cable customer service rep with grace, she adjusted my bill and even gave us a better rate for my troubles. When I apologized to my friend with grace, she forgave my mistake and seemed to appreciate me more. A heartfelt word or two prayed with a busy mom or caregiver can be worth 1,000 words in the ear of God. He hears them clearly and responds often in a way that surprises us. What word or phrase can you adopt to invite God into your boat, calming the waves of chaos and turning your tasks into blessings? Let the little children come to me. Matthew 19, verse 14. Tailor a prayer for each child. My cousin Sue wrote a lullaby for each of her 9 children specific to them, then she sang to them throughout their childhood. Not all of us can write songs, but we do know our children individually and intimately. God paired us with them, knowing we can help bridge their gaps and enhance their gifts. Why not pull all of that into a prayer tailored just for them? We can pray that blessing over them as they sleep, when they leave the house in the morning, while we fold their clothes or cook their meals. As Stormy O'Martian, author of The Power of Praying, put it, we don't have to be perfect parents. We just need to be praying parents. What do each of your kids need to grow into the people God created them to be? What hopes and dreams do you have for each child? Can you put all of that into a prayer that you pray over them constantly? When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" John chapter 4. Verse 7. Stay and listen at the well. When a Samaritan woman meets Jesus at the well, he asks her for a drink. She knows that Jews don't associate with Samaritans and tells him so. Back and forth, the conversation goes, with Jesus recounting the woman's relationship mistakes. What strikes me most about this passage isn't the social norms Jesus broke, but that the Samaritan woman stays and listens to all Jesus has to say, regardless of the shame she must have felt. Had she slunk off or simply stopped listening, she would have missed out on the grace Jesus pours into her. She wouldn't have recognized her true thirst was spiritual and had it quenched by him. So often the distress we feel in our spiritual thirst is our spiritual thirst making itself known. Take my habit of cutting my prayer time short whenever life got hectic. I needed to put out the day's fires, didn't I? But then I made a conscious decision to extend my prayer time when I felt overwhelmed and, most of all, to be still and to listen. Those turned out to be the moments that restored my soul. Emptying ourselves of all that's weighing us down is only one part of prayer. Yes, we may emerge with a lighter spirit because we've turned our burdens over to God, but we're robbing ourselves of the second part, letting Him refill us with the perspective to see things through His eyes and grace enough to face what lies before us. What are you struggling with right now? Is your struggle highlighting your thirst for Christ? What happens when you go to the well of God's grace and empty yourself out before Him? What happens if you stay long enough to listen and be refilled by Him? But the pot he was shaping from the clay was marred in his hand, so the potter formed it into another pot, shaping it as seemed best to him. Jeremiah 18, verse 4. Be flexible and open to change. My kids loved to play with Play-Doh. They had vivid imaginations and were great at bringing their visions to life. What they weren't great at was tightly closing their lids on their Play-Doh cans. The dough was always dried up and hardened. It wouldn't soften no matter what I did. I had no choice but to throw out batch after batch and buy new cans. I scolded my kids so many times. Why wouldn't they listen? Then I began to see all the ways I was stubborn and difficult to work with. How could God possibly mold me? This really stood out to me the year I had one medical issue after another. The resulting anxiety had me wound so tight I got stuck in my ways, rigid in how I parented, unyielding in my marriage, stern when I interacted with others. It wasn't until I found a scripture verse that spoke to my fear that things started to change. I typed the words of Jeremiah 18, verse 4, onto an index card, laminated it, and kept it in my back pocket. Every chance I got, I pulled out that verse and prayed it. Little by little, I softened. As God continued to work with me, stretch me and knead me, the anxiety dissipated. Finally, I surrendered to His will, and I realized there was nothing to fear because God held me in the palm of His hand. Is there something you're struggling with that is making you inflexible and hard? What scripture verse can you find that speaks to your situation? What happens when you pray that verse over and over? Prayer is our lifeline, especially at those moments we feel overwhelmed and ill-equipped. The more we remain connected to God, the more He can provide us with what we need, not only to survive, but to thrive, as mothers, as caregivers, as the people God created us to be. For more on this story, see Family Room. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.